Hundreds, if not thousands, of people may still be stuck on roofs and in attics. Rescue boats bypassing the dead to get to them. They're not even dealing with the dead bodies. They're just pushing them aside, they say. The flooding in New Orleans grew worse by the minute, prompting the evacuation now of hotels, hospitals, and the plan to drop sandbags from helicopters to close the breach levees is not working at all. They have no drinkable water. I am been told that Anheuser-Busch, our St. Louis company, of course, is sending in bottled water there to help people. And they need prayers and help to get out of this situation. In a moment, we will have open lines, and also Richard C. Hoagland will join us, and we'll continue chatting about the devastation caused by Hurricane Katrina on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Your phone calls this hour. I'm joined with Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, this gruesome story I had right before you came on about them just pushing bodies aside in New Orleans, trying to get to people who are on roofs or in attics. 100 people dead in Mississippi. What are we talking about in New Orleans where they haven't even counted them yet?
The worst scenario is that you have people trapped in their attics and they don't have axes or ways to claw their way through the roof and the, you know, the shingles and all that to get outside, and they literally are trapped with rising waters below and no way to get out above. And that's, that's a horrible nightmare, and that's what Jean Mazur was obviously thinking about as she was describing having to just leave those people, those that were able to call for help, and no one could come. So, and with water rising, I mean, if you wanted to lay out a scenario, worst possible horrific scenario, you could not have done worse. This is awful, and it's going to get worse. We're looking at, you know, Art was incredibly prophetic on Sunday night when he said, what if we lose an American city?
Well,
and
have.
At that time, I didn't think that it was possible just because of the way the engineering and the Army Corps of Engineers and how long this city has been there. But that's not factoring in that things are changing, George, and that's what, you know, Scott's discussion with me tonight was all about. This is not situation normal. The background physics for these storms is not what it was even as late as 1969 when Camille, you know, hit very close to New Orleans.
But had those levees held, Richard, we wouldn't have the devastation that we have.
And the reason the levees didn't hold is because when the storm took that jog to the east, the counterclockwise circulation blew the storm surge on Lake Pontchartrain into the levees, and you had waves, vicious whitecap waves, you know, lapping and flooding over those levees. And that, of course, these are soft levees. They're not hard levees, and they erode. And once you get a breach, the water coming through makes it bigger and bigger and bigger.
Absolutely.
So it's a cascade. And so it was really, it was, you know, you're between a rock and a hard place. If the storm had stayed on its original track, New Orleans would have been hit with the enormous 30-foot, now they're calculating, tidal surge, you know, storm surge, and the winds of 145 miles an hour. By going slightly to the east, it was on the soft side of the storm, the western side, so the winds were lower. The storm surge wasn't there, but Lake Pontchartrain, you know, hit them from basically behind. And so you had this law of unintended consequences that really, once this storm picked the region of New Orleans as its target, New Orleans, because of those levees, was probably doomed.
Did civil engineering fail in this case? Should they have known what to do? Maybe they should have had these levees built up stronger,
well,
maybe
of
higher.
Course. But see, no one is predicting and calculating and projecting an increased storm strength. When you talk to the climatologists, and you know, we didn't have Scott on long enough to get into that with him tonight, but the conventional guys, okay, the global warming guys, they're looking at models that basically show them. I saw one of them tonight on Fox, where he's arguing that only 10% of the increased hurricane strength storms can be correlated with increased sea temperatures, okay, surface sea temperatures, because the theory is that warm water fuels hurricanes. And what I'm saying and what Scott is saying and what our friend Jim McCanny is saying is that, hurricanes are a totally different animal. And for as long as there have been, you know, hurricane climatology scientists, they've been barking up, mixing our metaphors madly here, the wrong tree. And unless they get a handle on what really makes a hurricane run, they will not understand that as we move through this succeeding set of years, as the physics rises, regardless of what the sea temperatures do, the hurricane strengths are going to increase, and you're going to have more of them targeted at the weakest parts of the North American continent, to be very parochial here tonight. And it's inevitable. I mean, the worst case scenario, George, is that we've got this awful unfolding catastrophe. And as everyone has been saying, from Larry King to, you know, Tom Brokaw, what if we had another hurricane before the season ends?
And that's very, very possible.
It is. It's almost dead certain we're going to have more than one. The question, will we have more than one in the Gulf targeted at this now incredibly devastated region?
And, you know, this is as bad as any terrorist strike. Because
we've lost a whole city. It is even worse, because if you look at it in total energy, we used to, back in the days of Storm Fury, which was a project in the 1950s, where the government actually acted for a while to try to do things and maybe move hurricanes, and they used hurricane hunter aircraft, and they did seeding of silver iodide, and the idea was to try to seed a portion of the eye wall and weaken it by making it rain a lot. And then you could maybe move the storm, kind of like leading someone by the nose, to use a metaphor.
Right.
And they were calculating back then in, you know, Life magazine and, you know, New York Times and Ladies Own Journal, and look, the amount of power that a hurricane had compared to the newest toy of mankind, which was the atomic bomb. Remember those numbers? Remember the comparison between how many atomic bombs that have to be set off Hiroshima type to equal one hurricane?
Yes.
And we're talking millions.
Thousands.
Millions. So if you want, and this gets back to the discussion Scott and I were having, if you wanted the perfect weapon, forget the perfect storm, if you wanted the perfect weapon which would cause devastation over literally hundreds of thousands of square miles with no fingerprints, so no one could trace it to, quote, the enemy, if you could learn how to guide and steer these enormous vortices in the Earth's atmosphere and direct them to targets, you would have your perfect mass destruction weapon with no fallout.
See, I just find it hard to believe that anybody would have that kind of capability.
Well, then you probably need to see if Tom Bearden will come on as a guest, because Tom has been saying, you know who Tom is.
Yes.
He is a nuclear physicist, U.S. Army retired,
mm-hmm.
who has been saying for the last 10, 15 years that this capability not only had been developed primarily by the Soviets, but has been used in certain specific circumstances. And he has been pointing, long before Scott and myself kind of got into this game, at signatures in the atmosphere indicative of these so-called scalar interferometry type weapons, which is the technical term for the device that is used to create and steer these kinds of storms. And no one, you know, except a few of us crazies, paid any attention to him. And then last year, as I was doing, I forget what I was doing, and I've described this on the website, enterprisemission.com, I have a multi-part series we did called Hyperdimensional Hurricanes, where we basically started our own analysis, completely separate from Bearden. I didn't know that Scott, you know, Stevens existed. We were just looking at the signatures, at these incredible geometric signatures in the eyes of key storms, particularly Isabel and Ivan last year, and noticing what some of the networks, particularly MSNBC, was doing in the way of their hurricane promos, where they have this kind of graphic red spiral schematic of a hurricane.
Yes.
Over the actual close-up imagery from the GOES satellite, time-lapse data, showing this incredible pentagonal geometric eye. And I looked at this and I started backtracking through the net and through NOAA and the archive websites and the, you know, the National Hurricane Center and all that. And I found that there was this stunning library of major Category 5 storms that showed this astonishing regular geometry, which looked for all the world as if someone had taken a technology and had resonated this storm to A, rev it up, and B, to steer it. Then I started looking at the detailed tracks of the four hurricanes of last year. I mean, we had two of them. I think it was Francis and Jean that came ashore within, get this, George, 1 mile of each other.
Yeah, I know. I agree with you. It is, okay? It is strange.
Then we had the other two, which was, what, Charlie and Ivan, that came up the other side and went hit Florida from the west.
Yeah.
They all wound up, all three, Charlie, Francis, and Jean, crossing in the center of the state, kind of southeast of Tampa, within a mile. If you look at the tracks, they all cross in the middle of Florida, which is nuts, unless someone was using the state of Florida last year for target practice. Now,
or,
in the series, I didn't say that.
Or they were trying to get close to those refineries and missed.
Or, well, target practice missing, you know, you got to kind of, you know, it's like ranging, you know, when you duck hunt, you know, or remember the old artillery shells where they would get the range and they would, you know, in other words, we're dealing with incredibly complex systems, enormous energy, and it's going to take some testing to get it down to where you can do what you want to do. Last year, you know, to my naive approach, looked like tests. This year, we've got Hurricane 10, Katrina, and it makes a beeline for our most vulnerable. I mean, New Orleans is not really the problem, as awful as that may sound, with 1.3 million people out of home and most of them away from New Orleans tonight, stranded, unable to get home, and those 100,000 in New Orleans at risk, at peril, tonight sitting in the dark. But the real problem strategically is that at the mouth of the Mississippi, at the port of Louisiana, we have the waterway to the entire central United States. We have more tonnage of stuff, goods, you know, products, consumer items, everything, oil, you know, gas, tractor trailers, you know, trains, cars, you name it, goes up and down the Mississippi on those barges and feeds the entire center part of these United States.
That's absolutely right.
If you could bottle up the Mississippi, if you could block it, you know, and you know how hard the Army Corps of Engineers works to dredge the Mississippi to prevent that from happening just because of natural forces. But if you could cause the expenditure of the energy equivalent to tens or hundreds or thousands of atomic bombs and create a closure of that waterway, you would have a paralyzing, devastating effect on these United States without firing a shot. So what I wanted to do in the blogs that I've been writing and in the discussion with Scott tonight was to raise the issue, not to say that we have absolute proof that this, in fact, is what's happening, but we'd be dumb, George, and crazy and stupid in this era where nothing is the way it has ever been anymore.
But you
temper it. Look at these options and ask, is this possible?
No, but you temper it a little bit more than Scott does. I mean, he's vehement that the Russians have some equipment.
Scott's a new Catholic, all right? Remember when you and I were raised as Catholics and the most vigorous Catholics were the converts? Scott has come to this as a professional meteorologist, and it's for him, think of what it must be like for a professional scientist who has basically created a life career of trying to forecast weather to help people, and he suddenly discovers that the very heart of his science is not what he was told. And that, furthermore, it's not just that there's a natural variance, but that the actual science is being misused by somebody as weapons to harm people, to hurt them, and to create economic catastrophe for this nation. How would you, in his position, react? So I can understand Scott being a little bit up there, because he needs to come to the appreciation that I have, and I think you have, that all in life is not the way you see it on CNN.
Correct. Let's go to the phones. We'll take calls with Richard C. Hoagland all through this hour, and I would ask you to restrict your calls to either reaction to the devastation of Hurricane Katrina or specific questions. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir. Welcome.
Thank you. I've been listening for about a year. First time I'm calling you. I just wanted to say that I saw a show on, I think it was the Discovery Channel, about 4 or 5 years ago, and there was they were talking about a bunch of psychics throughout the nation who had all had the same vision or the same dream about the U.S. coastline changing dramatically. And it really had to do with the oceans rising up and, various coastal cities being flooded out, including New York.
You're absolutely right. Gordon Michael Scallion being one of those. Edgar Cayce, of course, the dead late prophet, being one of those. As a matter of fact, you can see maps of both Scallion's and Edgar Cayce's vision of what this country, this continent, will look like when things begin to really, melt down and grow. And, you know, Richard, this could be an early sign of things to come.
Well, for all our coastal areas, this is a cautionary tale, because even if you don't have the catastrophe of winds of 150 miles an hour and storm surges 30 feet high, which has done this extraordinary damage to Mississippi. I mean, Biloxi, as Governor Barbour said this afternoon, looks like Hiroshima, and I thought that was an extraordinary, simile, given what the president was doing on the West Coast, celebrating our winning of the war 60-some years ago. But the normal effect of simply melting the Antarctic ice cap, if global warming, if the progression of glacial melting that we've seen, and Art has done several shows on this, showing the satellite imagery of the northern and southern polar caps, then and now, and the extraordinary shrinkage of ice that you can see easily in these long-term images. If the southern ice cap, which sits on the continent of Antarctica, simply keeps melting at the accelerating rate it's now doing, the sea level rise of even a few feet will inundate coastal cities and flood them, like we're seeing New Orleans on the aerial helicopter shots all during the day and night. So this is a cautionary tale, regardless of whether there's the intervention of the hand of man here, because the physics itself is making coastal regions less desirable to place structures and people on.
What are they going to do, assuming the water recedes, and I'm not so sure it will?
It can't. George, it can't. It's sitting in a basin.
There's no place to go, right? It's become a lake to itself.
It is a lake, and there's a very ironic simile here or comparison. Lisa Lyon, and this afternoon when she and I talked, she wanted me to bring this up, and it was a really cool idea, so I will. She said, make sure you bring out the comparison between what's happening in New Orleans now and the Salton Sea.
Let's do that when we come back.
Okay.
And you can explain what that all means, because that was an experiment went really wrong. We'll be back in a moment. We'll continue to take your phone calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. By the way, as we approach Labor Day weekend, I will have a program, of course, for you Sunday. I'll be on Sunday. I do the first Sunday of every month. And we'll have a live Labor Day Monday night show as well. So just circle your calendar. We'll be right back. We'll take the rest of your phone calls and continue our chat with Richard C. Hoagland on Coast to Coast AM. A few years ago, the Navy sent me to New Orleans and, for a special training program. And it's hard to believe that Bourbon Street and things like that are just simply all gone. All gone. Richard, we'll talk about the Salton Sea in a minute. Let's take a few calls here. We've got some people that were jammed up from last hour, of course. So Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Richard C. Hoagland and me on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello. Go ahead. Don't have time for that. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yeah, go ahead.
Cheryl from Linfield, Mass.
Yes, sure.
I love your show. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I just wanted to kind of relate something that occurred about 30 years ago. I had a friend who was going to a student at MIT, and he was very successful in some experiments in controlling the weather. And he apparently the word got out, and he got a visit from the military. And the military asked him if he could expand this experiment for use as a weapon. And he was real shook up about it. And shook up enough that he eventually left school because he had told him he didn't want any part of it. And he kind of dropped out of sight, and I never saw him again.
You don't think he's the prototype for what might be happening, do you?
I have no idea, but when Scott said something about this being developed 30 years ago, it jogged my memory. And it brought it all back, and it was amazing that I had forgotten about that.
And no one knows what happened to the guy.
I have no idea. I mean, he left school a short time later. I know that the last time I saw him, he was very upset and very nervous that the military had found out about it, had paid him a visit, and his professor, and they wanted to know if he could expand the program for it to be developed into a weapon.
Go figure. Go figure. Richard C. Hoagland, tell us a little bit about the Salton Sea. Hello, Richard C. Well, we're going to have to get Richard C. back. Richard, are you there?
I'm trying to be.
There you are.
Gosh, that's weird.
It is.
That caller just brought to mind another example. Remember the story of Wilhelm Reich?
Yes.
The Orgone cloud-busting physicist.
And they arrest him. They put him away. They stole all his files and equipment.
And he dies in jail.
And he dies in jail.
And he was able to change weather. And, of course, my dear friend Gene Mayoff, before he was killed, gave me ample evidence that the people who have followed in Reich's footsteps, you know, people that I won't mention tonight on the air, but these are real physicists who have created real technology, picking up where Reich left off, prove that Reich was onto something. It's a real physics. It can really control these processes through control of the ether. When Bearden and I talk about, you know, scalar technology or hyperdimensional technology, we're talking about the same technology that Reich was talking about. So I am not surprised at all that if there was a bright kid at MIT who was tinkering and fooling around back 30 years ago, he would have gotten a visit.
And maybe they grabbed him and he's
working on the program in some
absolutely
dark cellar, yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, the Salton Sea thing that Lisa wanted me to remind everybody is this several hundred square mile lake in the south part of the Imperial Valley in central California down toward Mexico. And I remember I used to see photographs of it from the early spacecraft, the Mercurys and Geminis. There'd be these photos of Southern California and this jewel of a lake set between these very high, rugged mountains of Southern California. And I wondered back then, I mean, this is the 60s, I was in school, how did that lake get to be there? Well, it turns out it was a tragic accident. It turns out that the farmers back in the latter part of the 1900s, or the 1800s rather, the beginning of the 20th century, wanted to grow crops in the Imperial Valley, and they needed water. You need water in a desert. You need water in the Southern California. So they paid a company. They created a company called the Imperial Canal Company to basically bring water from the Colorado River to the Imperial Valley. And then when the canal started to silt up, they asked them to make it bigger, which they did, and they made a temporary diversion of the Colorado River to replace the block canal, which then breached by flooding and wound up flooding this basin in the middle of the Imperial Valley, now called the Salton Sea. And the water's poured in from the Colorado, George, for years until 1906, the Southern Pacific Railroad actually was able to close the breaches by dumping railway cars in the gaps, causing the water to slow down enough to where they could then use sand and rock and stuff like that to basically make a wall for a levee and basically seal it. And then, of course, the Salton Sea was landlocked and has been there and been there and been there for over 100 years.
How long would it take to pump out New Orleans if they sealed the ruptured levees?
You know, I don't know. I'd have to do the calculation, but I think it's longer than the 3 months that the mayor optimistically said that everything would be back to normal this afternoon. I don't think we are looking at a livable New Orleans for a year or maybe two.
Maybe.
If nothing else happens.
And what about some of these houses? I mean, what happens to a house, for example, that is submerged? I mean, do you have to level it and build a brand new one? How do you repair something like
well,
that?
Well, if it was submerged in ordinary water, let's say seawater or freshwater, you'd have the normal problems of mold and, you know, water tends to decompose wood and
right.
things like that. But this is not ordinary water, George. If you've been following the news, you know that there is a bizarre mixture of petrochemicals,
yes.
gasoline.
This is horrible.
Horrible human waste, bodies floating along in coffins because they bury people in a very strange way in New Orleans. They bury them above ground. So you've got what they call gumbo, which is a very euphemistic term. And this stuff will not only, you know, enhance the development of bacteria in the walls, even when they drain the swamp. It also will leave a toxic residue that would kill you if you tried to live in the house afterwards. So we're basically talking about the destruction, the literal leveling and the rebuilding of tens upon tens of thousands of old wooden frame homes. And it's just this is a catastrophe of biblical proportions unfolding on satellite television.
First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, my name is Chuck McCall from Maryland.
Hi, Chuck. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, Doug. Look, to answer your question, I've seen on the news that they say if all the pumps were working and they had a place to put the water, they could pump an inch an hour. So 12-hour period, 1 foot. That's what they said anyway. But my question was, earlier you talked about coastal cities, Venice. There's another city that's going through this problem. It's been, you know, happening for years with flooding and stuff. But the thing I've seen and have a question about, you know, with all the devastation that I saw and the damage that was done in mm-hmm. New Orleans and Mississippi, I mean, maybe you can answer this question and give me understanding. They want us to help, you know, for all the donations. But from what I understand, the oil refineries is what shut down. Why is the price of oil by the drum, crude oil raise, rise up the price, and what would the benefit of releasing the oil from the, reserve, how would that help if the refineries is the problem? I don't understand that.
Well, no, I agree with you. Finding other sources of oil is not going to solve the problem. We can't refine it right now. And Richard, isn't it ironic, isn't it strange, that the gasoline that's in the tanks now in gasoline stations around this country have already raised their prices because of this catastrophe, yet that gasoline was already paid for and in the ground way before this?
Yeah,
how can
well,
they
that's
do this
the way,
to us?
That's always how the futures markets work. You know, you're basically betting on the coming, on the future. And with the idea that the supply will be curtailed or it will be lessened or not there, obviously, with the supply and demand, you know, the gas station owners or the big companies are going to raise the price to get more out of what they can get for what they've already got. There's no mystery there. That's just good old American economics.
Or gouging east
well,
of the yeah, Rockies.
But that's what economics ultimately, if you go to Adam Smith, is all about, isn't it? What we really need to do is to look at this as a nation and decide, do we want to continue down this path? Because with 40% of our refining and you know, domestic production capacity in the Gulf. Even with conventional models, forget what Scott and I were discussing earlier tonight. Let's just assume hurricanes are just good old thermal systems, right?
Right.
When you have Gulf waters that are at 92 degrees Fahrenheit, can you imagine a natural body of water at 92 degrees, George, when the top used to be 85 10 years ago? So you have a cauldron there, a huge cauldron called the Gulf of Mexico, where any tropical storm wandering in to the Gulf will have a feeding frenzy and could, just from natural sources, develop into a major hurricane that, because of the way the winds move and the planet mm-hmm. rotates and all that, will move north toward this most vulnerable coast, which has got our oil capacity, our refining capacity, and our gateway to the Midwest all in one place. It is a recipe for catastrophe, and we're seeing the beginnings of that tonight.
I mean, and what I just find so hard to believe, here's this right on the heels of the December 26 tsunami. And I thought in my lifetime that may be the biggest catastrophe I had ever seen, and 300,000 people dead and everything else. And all of a sudden, we get another catastrophe on top of another catastrophe. It seems like this is going to go on forever.
Well, if you look at it from our perspective, going back to the model that I've been working on, which is the hyperdimensional physics model, which basically looks, and I've done programs with Art on this, and I think you and I have done a couple, all the planets in the solar system are showing very severe signs of enormous energy increases. The Earth is not. It cannot be accepted from that collection. It is a system.
So the
Earth is undergoing the same changes. You know, colloquially, you were talking before about Earth changes. Well, this is what they are. They not only create more storms, they create higher wind velocities, they create earthquakes, they create volcanic, you know, activity. It's dumping energy into the planet, and the planet relieves itself. You know, energy has to escape.
It's got to go somewhere.
These mechanisms. So, yes, this is a trend curve which is going to get worse. And what I've been saying, and a couple other people, I guess Scott now is on my team, we need to get a handle on the physics and technology which has been developed in secret, because it's that physics and technology which can be used to ameliorate or, in fact, even prevent some of these so-called natural catastrophes such as Katrina.
I wonder what some politicians who listen to this program in Washington, D.C. on WMAL must be thinking when they hear us talking about this right now, and they're totally unaware of the possibility that weather like this can be manipulated.
Well,
I wonder
see,
what they
is,
do tomorrow morning.
This is the consequence of what I call the national security state. Back in 1947, when President Truman signed the National Security Act, basically creating two political societies, you know, the secret government that runs things behind the scene to keep us safe, right? During
right.
the Cold War, the big thing with the Russians and all that. But what it also did is it set up, it legalized a way for the black ops crowd, the secret crowd that are not accountable to Congress, to pilfer the national treasury to the tune of tens of billions of dollars every year, George. Now, can you imagine what science projects and what technological projects could do with billions and billions and billions of dollars off the books if it only cost a couple billion to develop the atomic bomb and the Manhattan Project, you know, in 1945? What could they have developed in secret that is not even on the books that no one knows about because it's been behind gate after gate after gate of national security? So you've got this in crowd of scientists and physicists and mathematicians and computer experts and material scientists and technologists. You have an independent state within a state that has developed extraordinary capabilities, and they're not sharing them with the rest of us in the real world.
East
and
to
that's
the
what we have to break down.
You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is
yes,
Reed
sir.
From Chicago.
Hello,
I had
Reed.
A question for you and Richard.
Sure thing.
Yes, I was noticing while I was watching the Weather Channel on the regional radar as the hurricane was approaching New Orleans that a huge high-pressure wind just shot across Texas and just ripped thunderstorms apart, turned them into like smoke, just as the hurricane was approaching New Orleans. And I was wondering what your views might be as to whether that was an attempt to slow down the hurricane or move it off away from New Orleans. And I'll get off the line to listen to your answer.
Okay. Do you want to react to that, Richard?
George, that is a very perceptive caller, because that's exactly what I was told by my inside source two nights ago, that at the 11th hour, our guys, the good guys, try to intervene with this same technology to deflect this storm from basically clobbering New Orleans. And you got to look at, you know, as you were talking to Scott, you know, you asked him about signatures, things he would be seeing. That's exactly what was seen, and no one can explain it from a mainstream point of view. You suddenly had this dry air sweeping in from the west, sucking the energy out of the hurricane, deflecting it just slightly, and as the caller noted, obliterating some of the thunderstorms that were in part of those rain bands north of the storm as a kind of a telltale dye in the water. Remember the movie called Predator?
Yes.
The one with Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Yes.
And they're chasing this alien in the woods, and the alien can control his visibility. So all you see is a kind of a shadow here and a refraction there.
Kind of clear, but jelly.
Exactly. That's what this caller is describing. Looking at the radar, what he was seeing was the effects on the storms. He wasn't seeing the actual air, but the effect they were having on the processes, the thermodynamic processes already going on. That is evidence, real-world evidence, of what my source told me they attempted to do at the 11th hour, which was to change the course of the storm and spare New Orleans.
Well, I'll tell you, meteorologists are scratching their heads because of this dry puff of air, because they have no idea how it popped up at the last minute.
And they never will, George, because their paradigm, as Scott said so eloquently, does not permit it. As long as you think these things are just thermal engines, you know, hot water, convection, rising water vapor, condensation, that kind of thing, you'll never crack what they really are and how they're really controlled.
Well, Richard, over the next couple of days, I'm sure we'll get more information about that tragedy in New Orleans. So we'll just continue to monitor that. And as usual, my friend, thank you so much for spending your time updating us on all these many, many things that are happening.
Well, thank you for holding down the fort and being a beacon of light in a very, very dark night.
I have a feeling, Richard C., that there are going to be many nights like this.
Well, we'll spend them together then.
All right, my friend. You take care.
You too.
Richard C. Hoagland, enterprisemission.com. If you haven't had an opportunity to read his blogs on a regular basis, you're missing something. So do that, enterprisemission.com. I'm George Norrie, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another edition of Coast to Coast AM. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. And by the way, thank you to all these people who have just been working around the clock over the last several days trying to bring you the latest in this very tragic situation. I'm George Norrie. Take care, everyone.